Welcome back, everybody. And so for this afternoon's session, we're going to take the opportunity to have a bit more of a close look at some of the suttas, which are dealing with meditation, which we have been assigned for your reading for this month. And we have a little bit of a technical problem yet with the computer, so I can't show a slideshow and the web browser at the same time. I can either do a slideshow or I can have the sutta texts. So since I thought we were mainly looking at sutta texts, I thought I'd give up on trying to do a slideshow as well. So anyway, so we'll just have a look at some of these suttas. And these suttas were chosen because they illustrate what I think are some of the most important aspects of early Buddhist meditation. Now, of course, there are hundreds, probably thousands of suttas in the Pali Canon and the other early Buddhist texts which deal with meditation in all kinds of ways. And because, that situation, of course, comes very naturally because these things are records of oral teachings, yes? So there are just different occasions when people would come up and ask the Buddha about meditation or he would teach a different aspect and so on. And so throughout, you can find many, many different ways of putting things, many different approaches and emphases in the meditation throughout all of that. Of course, there are some things which we find repeatedly as an overall theme or emphasis. One of those themes, for example, would be that idea I mentioned before about how this is a natural process. Also, I mentioned earlier about that idea of that balance in terms of that samatha and vipassana, the wisdom side and the emotional side, and balancing those aspects in meditation, and so on. So there's different things which we find repeatedly as themes again and again. Another aspect which we find emphasized throughout them is a very kind of matter-of-fact, down-to-earth, common-sense approach that the Buddha used to meditation. He's talking about ordinary experiences, thoughts and feelings which everybody can share and everybody can relate to. And there's also a very pragmatic approach in the sense of how to overcome particular difficulties and problems with meditation. Now, I can't go over all of those things by any means, but we'll just try looking at a few of them as a bit of a sample. My personal tendency is to be a bit suspicious of things that try to be too methodical. And I always, whenever I see something that's a very kind of methodical classification and approach to suttas and things like that, I kind of think, well, yeah, that's kind of nice, but it's not really how life works too much, is it? Yeah? It can be useful, but the reality is it's all a bit messy and a bit loose, and well, sometimes we say this works like that, but actually it works like the other way, and then sometimes this part, you can study the whole system of things, but actually the system doesn't really matter. What really matters is what's this that I need right here, right now. That's the important thing. So characteristic of the Buddha's teachings means that if we're going to be learning from meditation from the early Buddhist texts, we're going to want to have, in a sense, a twofold approach, two things that are important. The first thing is important is having some idea of like a systematic or a methodical understanding of the teachings as a whole. So understanding the basic principles underlying things like samatha and vipassana and their relationship, things like the role of samadhi in the sense of sila samadhi panya and how it leads from the ethics towards the liberation and so on. And so understanding these overall principles that can help us to make sense of and to put in their place each of the individual teachings we read. So that's one thing which is very useful. The other thing which is very useful is an ability to find what we need when we need it, right? To be able to say, well, actually, I'm interested in this particular thing. You know, what did the Buddha say about, for example, sutra I have here, the Meghya Sutta? What did he have to say about, say, that what's the right time to meditate, and how do we use different kinds of meditations to overcome particular problems we might have in one particular case, right? So that might be a question that we have, and it's not easy to find that, right? You can't actually Google that, right? You can try, but it's going to be a bit of a subtle thing to find. And so sometimes, you know, we need to learn those skills. Sometimes you can use the indexes in the book. Sometimes you can ask people around about it. But there's nothing that really beats just having a good level of expertise and spending time with the suttas. Yeah, general knowledge of the suttas, reading them on a regular basis, and you get familiar with things and you get familiar with how to find what it is that you need at the time that you need it and so on. Once again, I'm just showing off our new website, Sutta Central, the best thing in the universe. What are you laughing? Yeah, the best thing in the universe, yeah. Well, the Dhamma is the best thing in the universe, right? So the best thing is like is freedom and liberation and the Dhamma and the practice of Dhamma, but that's not really a thing, right? So if you talk about objects, you know, like what could be better than the Buddha's words, right? And if you're putting the Buddha's words in the best way, then that's going to be the best thing in the universe. I mean it completely seriously. You guys are just laughing at me. Okay. So here's the Meghya Sutta. So for those of you who don't read Pali, then of course you have that wonderful Pali. Oh, look at that. It's very cool, right? Yeah. All right. Not too shabby, huh? Yeah. The simple pleasures in life, yes. You think it's a simple pleasure? You can write you can analyze Pali grammar in JavaScript if you like, and then you can come back and say how simple it is. Okay. Anyway. Meghya Sutta. That's enough playing around. Let's just read it in Thai now. Or in Sinhala. Or in Devanagari. Oh, hang on. I'm missing out. Okay, here we go. Back to the Meghya Sutta. This is Venerable Tanisaro's translation. We have... It's better. Maybe I'll read Ayana's translation. One time the Blessed One was saying in Sabati and he said, top of the morning to you. Okay. No. Buddha was staying in Chalika, on Chalika Hill. At that time, the Venerable Meghya was the Lord's attendant. When the Venerable Meghya approached the Buddha, prostrated himself and stood to one side. So, of course, we know from Buddhist tradition that the Venerable Ananda was the Buddha's attendant, especially for the last period of the Buddha's life, the last half of Buddha's life. So this presumably is set in the early period. Where's Chalika? Don't really know. A somewhat obscure little place. Meghya approached, he says he wants to go to the Jantu village for alms food. So he went in for alms round, came back, and then he saw the bank of the river Kimikala. Wandered up and down the river, and then he saw a charming mango grove, and he thought, oh, that's very pleasant. It's suitable for the endeavour, striving of a young man of good family who's intent on the striving. If the Lord were to give me permission, I would come and endeavour in this mango grove. When it says endeavour, actually, it's just the word, it just really means meditation. And so Meghya comes back and tells the Buddha the story, and the Buddha says, as we're alone, Meghya, wait a while until some other bhikkhu comes. And then Meghya said to him, but Bhante, you don't have to, you've got nothing more to be done. But for me, I have something further that I need to do, something to add to it. If you give me permission, I would go to that mango grove to strive in meditation. And the Buddha says, well, we're alone, wait a while till some other bhikkhu comes. And then for a second time and a third time, he speaks of going away to strive in meditation. So, well, this is a bit... I mean, this is the Buddha we're talking about, right? And he's giving you some advice on how you do your meditation, and he's just saying, no, I just want to go and do it anyway. This gives you a lot of solace when you're a Dhamma teacher. You read these kind of things, and you're like, So, but it's an interesting situation, isn't it? You know, the Buddha then says, well, you're talking about going away to meditate. What can I say? Do as you see fit. So the Buddha doesn't say... I'm the Buddha, you have to listen to me, right? He doesn't sort of pull a power trip. He doesn't say, stay here and that's an order, right? He gives him a reason. He says, well, look, we're alone, you know, wait here till someone else comes. And so he gives him a reason, encourages him to stay. Now, obviously, the Buddha had his reasons for doing this. Yeah? He's not forcing him, he's not commanding. Eventually, maybe he says, look, I'm going to go and do it anyway. He doesn't sort of resent him. He doesn't say, you're a bad student. If you disobey me, you can never come back and study with me again, or any of this kind of silliness, right? It's okay. If you insist, you go. So he went away to the mango grove. And, of course, it's beset by all kinds of unwholesome thoughts. Sensual thought, malevolent thought, and cruel thought. Of course, the three classic kind of wrong thought in the Eightfold Path. And Venerable Megi thought, it's strange, it's indeed remarkable. I've gone forth out of faith into the home of Say, yet I'm overwhelmed by these three bad, unwholesome kinds of thoughts. So that's also, I think, quite reassuring, isn't it? You know, this is sometimes when we hear the stories, you know, we hear a lot of stories from the time of the Buddha, and there's, you know, great monks, and they're all so enlightened and so profound and wisdom and all of these things. Or else you hear like the really bad ones, like Devadatta, who are really evil and nasty and so on. But actually, most of them were not like that. Most of them were something like Megia. You know, he went forth, he was sincere, he wanted to practice. But maybe he had some stubbornness in him, you know, maybe he wasn't really listening properly to when his teacher was giving him some guidance, so he made some mistakes here and there, and, you know, but he still wanted to try, yeah? And so he came back to the Buddha, and the Buddha, you know, there's no sense, or you don't get even the slightest hint that the Buddha resented the fact that he disobeyed him or anything like that. Instead, all that he would do is always he would teach him the Dhamma and try to help him. When the deliverance of the mind is as yet immature, Meghia, five things lead to its maturity. Very, very important. Notice how the Buddha's approach here. He's not rebuking him. He's not saying, nah, 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 told you so. That's what I'd do, right? Okay? That's why I'm not the Buddha, and he is, okay? Then, my deliverance is as yet immature. Five things lead to its maturity. And again, notice that he's not saying, well, you need to go back there and do it some more. Stop your whinging and just note all those phenomena as they happen. Keep on meditating. This is just a stage in your development of insight, and the more that it hurts you, the better it is for you. And try harder and do this method and try this and try that. No, no, no. He's saying, and what he's also not saying, he's not saying, well, this is your bad karma, right? You can't do it, you're a bad meditator, this is your bad... No, when there are five factors that lead to the maturity of the mind, okay? His mind is not ready to be going into that place. I mean, it's not an easy thing to be going and sitting in the middle of the forest by yourself all day and just doing the meditation. I don't know what Indian mango groves are. I find it strange because they always have this thing about going to mango groves to meditate, right? But I know from in Thailand, mango groves are horrible places to meditate. Because they have all these big red ants in them. Yeah, do you have them in Sri Lanka?
Yeah.
So what are they doing going and meditating? They must be massacres.
Isn't it because of these mangoes, really good mango trees provide those beautiful shade?
Yeah, for the big red biting ants, yeah. maybe they don't have them in India. I mean, they're really nice trees and shade and stuff. Maybe it's a different season or something like that, but certainly in Thailand, it's a nightmare. Yeah, these bred ants, as soon as they see you coming, they're like... Anyway, I had one go into my ear and eat my brain one time. Yeah. Okay, moving along. It's true, I've never been the same since. Yeah. It's a long story. I was staying by myself. Eventually I got to see the doctor, and the doctor shines this thing down my ear and he says, oh my God. Great bedside now. Yeah. Okay. Then five things leading to its maturity. So he's getting, well, this is how to help. This is what you need to work on. Remember all those supporting conditions, yeah? That flow of that meditation leading onwards, right? It's not, don't force the meditation when it's not ready, but look at what are the conditions for it that are leading to the support of that meditation. First one, Bhikkhu has good friends, good associates, and good companions, okay? That's the first thing that leads to support the mind, okay? That's the first thing. When you have good friends around you, very good common sense, right? And if you're surrounded by people who you don't like to meditate and, you know, leading you in bad ways and all of these things, or hassling you and things, and it's really hard. Next one, sila. A bhikkhu is virtuous, keeps the sila. He lives restrained by the restraint of the Patimokkha, the 227 rules for the bhikkhus, endowed with conduct and resort. Endowed with conduct just means the sort of good behaviour and so on. What resort refers to is that it's resort specifically is to do with the places that you go for alms round. Okay, so that if the idea is basically that if you go around and hang in the tavern or something like that for alms round, and then you know you're perhaps likely to hang around with people who are not going to be such a good influence, right? So this is the resort, is you go to the right places for the alms. Seeing danger in the smallest faults, he trains in the training rules he has accepted. Okay, so it's the second thing, so keeping the precepts. Third thing, a bhikkhu attains at will with no trouble or difficulty talk. Hang on, what are we talking about here? We're talking about how to develop meditation. Surely you can only develop meditation if you're keeping noble silence. Nobody's allowed to talk. That's how you develop meditation. Obviously, Buddha's got it wrong. Someone send him an email. We've got a correctly sutta. Okay, good thing I'm running the sutta site now, so whenever I find mistakes like this, I can just go and correct them in the Pali text, right? Easy. So, no, actually he's not saying you have to be silent and you can't talk all the time. He attains it will without trouble or difficulty. Talk that is effacing. Effacing is a translation of a Pali term. What it means is conducive to the letting go of defilements, basically. A help in opening the mind, which conduces to complete turning away, dispassion, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, enlightenment, and nibbana. That is, talk about fewness of wishes. Talk about contentment. Talk about seclusion. Talk about being non-gregarious. Okay, that means not just hanging around and socializing for the sake of it. Talk about putting forth energy. Talk about virtue. Talk about samadhi. Talk about wisdom. Talk about freedom. Talk about the knowledge and vision of deliverance or freedom. When the liberation of the mind is as yet immature, make here, this is the third thing that leads to its maturity. Okay, so having those good friends, good companions, keeping the precepts, and from time to time, having the chance to talk about meditation, talk about contentment, talk about the Dhamma. It's very, very important. It's why we have the discussion groups in these sessions. This is part of that practice, part of that thing. And I know that it's not easy for most people to get that, right? It's not easy to have friends who you can talk about with. And so this is important that we provide that opportunity. Further, Meghya, bhikkhu lives with energy instigated for the abandoning of unwholesome dhammas and the acquiring of wholesome dhammas. He's vigorous, energetic, and persevering. Okay, so not giving up. Not being lazy when it comes to practice. And the fifth one, bhikkhu is wise, with noble one's penetrative understanding of rise and fall, leading to the complete ending of suffering. So ideally, of course, this is the wisdom of stream entry or enlightenment, but at a more basic level then just if you have that right view and that understanding of things as being impermanent and so on, then this is also supportive. Okay, so these are the five things, but those five things are not just random things and they're not disconnected things. In the next paragraph, and the Buddha goes on to say, well, I've taught these five things, but they support each other. It's to be expected that a bhikkhu has good friends and good companions, that he'll have keep his precepts. Okay? Very true. Yeah? If you're hanging around with people who are keeping a good code of conduct and who have been harmless and being kind and so on, then that encourages you to do the same thing. This is how we basically learn good behavior. And similarly, if you have good friends and you're keeping sila, then it's you'll be expected that you'll have people to talk about the Dhamma with. And then if you have people to talk about Dhamma with, it's expected that you'll put forth effort and then have the wisdom as well. Okay, so they're all interconnected. And so to notice that this same pattern, we talked before about the pattern of the precepts leading to non-remorse, leading to joy and gladness and tranquility and so on, and that evolving process of meditation, it's very similar to what's been talked about here. The details are different, but the same idea is there, that there's this evolving process. We start out with the basic things, the simple things, and that we're with that process as it goes through to the more subtle ones. So if you have those five things, then you should also cultivate four additional things. So you what's translated here is foulness, to be cultivated for overcoming lust. Actually, the Pali word is asubha, which not really, it doesn't really mean foulness. And the word is actually down here. So asubha literally means unbeautiful. Okay, so subha, baha means radiant or light. Su means beautiful. A means un, right? So asubha means not beautiful or not radiant. And so this is usually for contemplation of the parts of the body. So like they contemplate the hair of the head, hair of the bone, hair of the body, hair of the head, nails, teeth and skin, and contemplate the bones and so on and so forth. So this is the body contemplation, which is part of the one of the meditation objects. And so this is for the abandoning. So asubha bhavetabha should be cultivated for the abandoning, removal, bahana, of raga, of dust and lie, or even lust and die. We're talking in the group before about how this can sometimes, viraga can be translated as dispassion. The opposite of it is dispassion, but also fading away. So raga, as well as being the passion or the lust that you have in your mind, is also the word that's used for the dye, that literally that dyes a cloth. And so this idea of that dispassion as being the fading away. And so if you're in a culture where you just have like plant dyes, then of course the natural thing is that as you wash them, that the colour will naturally come out of them, and you have to keep putting colour back in them to keep them bright. So if you have this cloth which is just naturally fading away, and of course, if that process continues, then eventually the cloth is just pure white again. Yeah? So this is what this idea of raga is. So these four kinds of things to be developed. And I think this is a wonderful list of meditation. So first of all, the body contemplation, and then the metta, loving kindness, metta, bhaveta, bah, to be developed for the abandoning of ill will or malevolence. Yeah? Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, should be developed for the cutting off of thoughts. Okay, in other words, for the stilling of thoughts on practices like anapanasati, and then contemplation of perception of impermanence. Yeah, should be developed for the uprooting of the pride of self or egotism. Okay. So just a bit of a shout out to Venerable Nandiya, who wrote this Pali dictionary thingy. So to recognize asmi mana samuggahataya as a Pali compound and break it up correctly is not a trivial exercise. So he's done that very well. So the pride of self. Okay. So I think this is really powerful and important list of meditation practices. Actually, if we look in the suttas, we do find these particular meditations taught very often, and we find variations of this set taught in different places. But this is, I think, one of the places where we find it sort of expressed most concisely and most precisely. This group of four meditations: contemplation of the body, metta, breath meditation, and contemplation of impermanence. And these are really, I think, the four most central, most core meditations in Buddhism, and we find these out throughout all the different Buddhist traditions, that these four things is what people tend to come back to. Even though there's so many different meditations we can do, but these four ones I think are really central. And again, notice that those principles that I talked of before in meditation, the principle of balance, this very balanced group of meditations, it's a very practical, it's a pragmatic one, right? Each one has its own function, and it fits within the purpose of the context of the path as a whole. And so the contemplation of impermanence, of course, being the vipassana side of this, and when you contemplate impermanence, you establish the perception of non-self, And then you remove the conceit, I am, which is called Nibbana, here and now. Okay, so this is the Meghya Sutta with these four kinds of meditation. Okay, so we've been talking for a while now. Let's have a bit of a break and do some meditation together.
Okay.
Yeah,
of course. I noticed that this isn't any like a lot of others, with the monk hanging away, very happy and smiling because I'm now at the end. And I think I'm after that monk because it's still going over my head. I still don't get this and what it's telling us about the long time to meditate. I'm probably exposing myself here, but I can't get it.
What can't you get?
The wrong, you know, this is headed up with the wrong times and everything.
Yeah.
That's obviously the message. I can't get what I'm being told about the wrong time to meditate that night. I can't get it.
Well, maybe you went off to meditate and it was the wrong time. It didn't work.
But you don't know why it was the wrong time.
That's right, the sutta doesn't tell us. So the sutta doesn't tell us why, what was the problem with Meghya. We don't know the background, we don't know his situation. All we know is that when he did go, it didn't work, and that this is what the Buddha said to that would be helpful. Yeah? So we can assume, you know, we can infer from what the Buddha's teachings was that Meghya needed more of a foundation in the, knowing the community life, in having good friends and having that support and all of those things. But that's all, you know, he's not giving us a...
I got really excited when I saw the heading. I'm telling you what's been a long time, what is that?
Don't worry about the heading, that's just something that I wrote down there to have something as a heading for the sutta.
Alright, okay. So I didn't really listen
to it. I don't think so.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Headings are just headings, right? Even if I write a heading down there, it's just something that I think of writing down at the time. But also the headings of the suttas in the actual text themselves is just something that some editor or redactor or whatever has thought of putting down there at some time, right? So the headings and titles aren't particularly important. They're just they're pretty arbitrary. So don't worry about them too much. Yeah. So I'm sorry if that was misleading. Anyway. Okay, so... next one, we have a lovely ad on the side there, but anyway, this is an ad about how to look cool in sunnies. This is sort of about how to look cool in sunnies. Anyway, and the bottom, mutants are coming to fight or die. Yeah, excellent. This is a good reason to not have a Tripitaka site based on a ad-supported format. anyway... sometimes these suttas depends on where they are and so on, but sometimes we don't have a whole lot of choice in terms of the which having translations. No, this is why I didn't put that one there, because we don't have the translation. Okay, so this is the Upakilesa Sutta. I won't read through this in detail. This one was translated by Sister Uplavana, who did a lot of translations of the suttas. Unfortunately, her translations are not very good. So I'm not going to go through this in too much detail because it is not going to be an excellent translation. Definitely using Bhikkhu Bodhi's is preferred. But just the main point about this particular sutra and the reason why it's here, and again I won't go into the background of it because I mainly want to focus on the meditation part of it. And the Buddha goes to see Venerable Anuruddha, Nandiya and Kimbila, and asks them if they're living comfortably, and then it's a very beautiful description of the life of the monastics as living together and living in harmony and helping each other. And all that part of it is very beautiful. But I'm not going to focus on that right at the moment. But then the Buddha goes on to say, well, look, as you live like that, you then attain some uttari manusa dhamma, some special knowledge above the human state. And so he says, well, yes, we do. So he's asked, basically he asks him, you know, have you got any kind of anything good happening in your meditation, right? So this is where he gets onto the interesting stuff. And then Anuruddha goes on to give a series of problems that he and his friends had encountered in their meditation. So obviously this was set before the time when Anuruddha was enlightened. And he says when he's abiding, meditating, then he perceives effulgence and beautiful forms, but then the light and the beautiful forms disappeared and we did not understand that sign. So this is that translation, but it's not really a good translation. Okay, so let's go to this particular sutta. Let's have a look at the Pali text. So just briefly, this is the same sutta, and this is the parallels for that sutta. So this sutta has some partial parallels in the Jatakas, another partial parallel in the Vinaya, a couple of parallels in Chinese, in fact four parallels in Chinese, well several parallels and partial parallels in Chinese and in Sanskrit, so quite a lot of parallels and partial parallels. Actually, most of those parallels will be for the setting and the background story, the Buddha and the quarrel in Kosambi, rather than for the meditation teachings as such. But anyway, so this is on Sutta Central, so this is how you find out where the different parallels for suttas are. And also on Sutta Central we have the Pali text. And if the dictionary is going to work... The dictionary has been a bit erratic, which I think means that it's not actually officially launched yet, and they're probably playing with it at the other end, so it's half the time it's working, half the time it's not. Anyway, I was going to look at that when the Buddha is talking about the appearance of light. So he said they're meditating... he says he obasancheva sanjanama dasanamcha rupanam. So he perceived radiant or light, or bhasa meaning light, or and he had a vision of forms, rupa. Okay, so this is what he's saying. So this is obviously what these days we call the nimitta, or the light that appears in meditations. So what happened is that these things appeared and then they disappeared, and that they didn't understand why they disappeared. This passage is a little bit confusing in Pali, and because it uses the word nimitta here, and normally we use the word nimitta to mean the light that happens in meditation. Actually, the word nimitta here doesn't mean that quite. The word nimitta here means cause. And so it's a bit confusing, because the word nimitta doesn't actually mean light when it's talking about meditation in the early texts. That's only a later meaning. The light is mentioned, but it's just called light, yeah? A perception of light. Nimitta here means a cause. And so the Buddha is saying, well, you should investigate the reason for that. So then the Buddha goes on to say, earlier, when he was a seeker of enlightenment, a bodhisattva, he too perceived light and the forms, and they disappeared. Then it occurred to me, why did these things disappear? Then he knew that doubts arose in me. Because of my doubts, the concentration, what's the word for concentration here? Vichikicca, Uddhapadi doubt arose, and when the Vichikicca arose, then the Samadhi fell away. When the Samadhi fell away, then the light and the beautiful forms fell away. So this is that process of investigation and inquiry that the Buddha's recommending. And again, notice these beautiful characteristics of the Buddha's teachings. Yeah? The first thing that he's doing is he's making a connection with them, right? The same thing happened to me, right? He doesn't say, you're hopeless, you're getting nowhere, whatever. Yeah, I know what that problem is. I understand it because I experienced the same thing. Again, this is something that I've been trying to emphasize in many of my Dhamma talks, and I'm putting this here because I'm trying to prove that I don't make this stuff up, right? And the Buddha had all these problems in his meditation, right? He wasn't Mr. Perfect. Well, he was later on, but he didn't start out as Mr. Perfect. He started out having all these problems and getting all these things wrong and stumbling. And what was he left up to? He had to investigate it and understand it, right? And now notice what he doesn't say to Anuruddha and so on is, this is the reason for it. Okay? Right? He doesn't read Anuruddha's mind and say, oh yeah, this problem is happening for this reason, and that's how you fix it. He says, you must investigate it. You must find out the reason for it. Okay? Now, when I did it, the same thing happened. I investigated and I found out that that was the reason. Yeah? So he's teaching them to follow that process, right? He's not telling them what the answer is. He's telling them what the method is. Yeah? So, first one, he gives his doubt, and then of course he gives a long list of different reasons why those lights and the visions and forms would fade away. sometimes from doubt, sometimes from not paying attention, sometimes from sloth and torpor. It was mentioned in our group earlier, this is a classic example of Buddhist hybrid English. It's these kind of words that we never use outside of a Buddhist context. So what sometimes better translated as dullness and drowsiness, yeah, or laziness or something like that. Another one, fear. Yeah, interesting analogy. He, in so many few of them, he gives a bit more of a simile. In this one, he says, like a man walking along the highway, he's attacked by murderers on both sides. In the same way, fear arose in him. Right. That's not just a bit of fear, right? He's not saying he felt a bit nervous, right? He's saying he felt a blind terror in his meditation. Yeah, and that's actually, that's quite not an uncommon thing. People do feel that from time to time when you're meditating. All of your feelings and emotions and responses and so on become so much more sensitive that they can all become amplified. And it's actually very easy for that fear to feed on itself and turn into a raging terror. Yeah? So, next one. Jubilation, right? That's quite a good translation, yeah? Jubilation. Whoopee! Hey, this is going great! Hey, I'm such a good meditator. Awesome. Right? Like a man who was in search of one treasure came across five treasures at the same time. Whoopee! So, of course, then all goes away. Yeah? And this is exactly what happens. Again, remember what I was saying before about how the process is important. Because if you talk about seeing a light in the meditation and these kinds of things, it's a bit hard to know exactly what he's meaning. But when you understand the process of what's happening, you can actually see that that's what happens. When you experience a nimitta or a light comes into your meditation, it's exactly these kinds of things that happen. The first thing is you doubt. So many people come to me and say, this experience happened, is this the real nimitta? Is this what I should be doing? Yeah? That's the doubt. Yeah? Or they experience it and the fear comes. Oh, what's that? Yeah? You've never experienced it before. Yeah? Or you have the jubilation. Whoopee, at last, I've got there. Yeah? Okay, so why? Another reason why, is it wickedness? What's wickedness? I don't think it means wickedness. What's wickedness? Let me see. Tinamidha chambhidatta upadhi dutulang. Ah, dutulang. Okay, so the Pali word here is, she's translated as wickedness in Pali is dutula, which means something more like disturbance. Okay, I would translate dutula as disturbance. In other places, when it talks about it, it talks about that this is something which needs to be pacified and stilled. So it sounds to me like disturbance is probably the kind of thing it means, like maybe kind of an anxiety or like a feeling of discomfort or something like that comes up in the meditation. Another way, too much aroused effort. Okay? Yeah, so excessive energy that can come from drinking too much coffee or I'm only kidding, there's no such thing. sometimes when you're practicing, you know, when you start to think things are going really well, yeah, and you go, oh, okay, now we're really going to go for it, yeah, so you're pushing too hard, yeah, so this is one problem. But then, of course, the opposite problem also happens. Beautiful simile here, a man who holds a handcart firmly with both hands would die with it. A handcart firmly with both hands? Hang on, that's not what it says. That makes no sense whatsoever. No, I don't think so. I think it means a bird. She's just misread it. It's actually a quail, a wataka. Yeah? So she misread the translation. So it's actually, if a man were handing with both hands a little quail, right? A wataka. Yeah? Yeah, that's right. So if you held it too tightly, if you held it too loosely, then it'll fly away. Atilina viryang, yeah? That's right.
The man would die with it.
No. That's just a mistranslation. The little birdie would die. That's a bit. That's a really bad translation, isn't it? Yeah. This is again. This is why we're making our sutta central site. It's because there's not really enough good translations of suttas on the web. Anyway. Okay. Then it occurred to me. Next one. Too much striving. Okay. We had that one. Too much striving. Various perceptions. Okay. So perceptions of diversity arose. Yeah. This also is something that can happen when you're meditating. What this means is that. When meditating, people can have all kinds of visions of things, right? So rather than having that, like a nimitta, the light that appears in meditation should be a feature of unification. It's the mind all coming together, so the mind appears as radiant because it's becoming purified and becoming clear. But sometimes when that happens, then you can start to get visions of different kinds of things. Now maybe that's imagination, maybe you're having some kind of psychic powers or something like that. Whatever it is, whether it's real or not, the point is that it's distracting you from your actual, the point of what you're doing, which is to meditate and to find peace. And so this is another thing which is actually not uncommon at all among meditators. When you get to a certain point in meditation, people start having visions of different things and they start to get interested in those visions rather than continuing with the meditation. Okay, and then another one, it says, thinking too much about forms. This is also quite an interesting one. I think I'm not exactly sure what it means, but I think it's similar in meaning to the previous one, Nanatasanya, and that's why I think it follows on from it, the perception of diversity. Ati nijhai tattang kome rupanam. So ati nijhai tattang literally is ati is too much. Nijhaita means to contemplate or to ponder over the forms, right? So it means that when the nimittas and the things come up, you're saying, oh, what is this? Is this the right nimitta? Is this what I should be doing? Is this the right way? And so you're thinking the meaning of it. Is this the jhana and so on? And you're contemplating it too much rather than just experiencing it. So this is a fantastic list of the different kind of obstacles in meditation. Of course, we're used to in Buddhism the list of, say, the five hindrances. It's a more common list. So I wanted to introduce a few other ones for you this afternoon to show you some different kinds of problems. Of course, these ones are on that more kind of refined level of meditation, when it's already becoming quite subtle, and then these kinds of obstacles appear when you've already reached a reasonably deep level of meditation. And so, of course, the Buddha understood all of these things, understood why the light of the meditation was passing away, and through understanding it was able to dispel those kinds of defilements. And then he, as he said, he saw both through day and night limited light and limited forms, and then limitless light and limitless forms throughout the day and the night. And then he developed that through the different stages of meditation until he realized enlightenment. So this is one of those suttas, which is very interesting because it's talking about the Buddha's own practice and how he attained enlightenment, and talking about that in a way which is a little bit different from the more ways that we're used to hearing about the process of enlightenment. So here, in this case, the insight, the understanding, comes from understanding the process of meditation itself. Right? Reflection on the meditation, why is it working, why is it not working, why is this happening, why is that happening, and this is where the understanding of the mind comes from. Okay, so let's have another meditation for the next 10 minutes. Before the last part of this session, I'd like to look at the meditation section of what we call the gradual training, and have a brief look at the formula for the four jhanas. As an expression of this idea of the process or the flow of meditation in the context of spiritual life as a whole, the most important teaching framework is that which is called the gradual training, or the anupubba sikha. And the gradual training is found in dozens of suttas all through the early Buddhist texts, and there are of course many variations on it, but the general form of it is always the same. Somebody hears the teachings, they decide to go forth, they undertake the precepts and various ways of practice leading up to going establishing mindfulness, are developed in the four jhanas, and then the higher knowledges before culminating in enlightenment. And so this kind of process is talking, in a way it's like a kind of a real life application or example of some of the more abstract principles that we were talking about before. We say the sutta on the keeping the precepts, leading to non-remorse, leading to happiness, and so on and so forth. Now, this teaching is a very profound and very important one, and we can only just skim over the top of it. Okay, so I'll just mention very briefly about this. So this is one particular version of the gradual training, Maha Asapura Sutta, Majjhima 39. Let's quickly, before we start, let's have a look at the parallels for this. Okay, so here's the parallels for the Maha Asapura Sutta. So you can see it has a number, two parallels in Chinese, and one Sanskrit fragment. Probably just a brief phrase, a few brief phrases. Okay. Where are we now? Okay, so the Buddha starts out with saying one should have a sense of conscience, so you have a sense of moral integrity. From there you develop your precepts, and bodily conduct should be clear, pure and open, unbroken and restrained. We shall not exalt ourselves or disparage others on account of our bodily conduct, the same with the verbal or the mental conduct. Okay, so this is just one of the stages to develop. From then, so this is of course the precepts, so this covers the ethics which you talked about previously. From there to the restraint of the senses. Okay, on seeing a form with the eye, we shall not grasp at any theme or variations. Oh, crikey, what's that kind of? That's a very musical translation there. Lesser or minor quality? No, not lesser or minor. Major or minor qualities is probably a better one. We grasp at any theme or variation. So what it means is nothing too complicated. All it simply means is, for example, when you first see something, you have an initial impression of something. This is like the major quality. It's an overall impression. It's a man, it's a woman, it's a person, it's an elephant, it's a dog, and so on. And then as you look at it longer, you gradually pick out different kinds of qualities. Okay, so you focus more on individual qualities and features. So that's all this is talking about. So you're being careful with your eye so that you're understanding that when you see certain things and that provokes certain emotional responses, and so you take care with that to make sure that you guard the eye faculty, similarly with the ear and the different senses. I don't have time to go into detail for all of these things, but just to notice in passing that these are all part of that process of developing that state of peace of mind leading into meditation. It's very, very interesting. Just the other day we had a meeting, and one of the fellows in the meeting was kind enough to drive me home, and he's formerly lived in Sydney, now is living in the Blue Mountains, and he was just saying how much of a shock to the system it was when he comes down to the city, and then all of this stuff is all around him all of a sudden. He's used to the peacefulness of being in the forests, and then you're suddenly assailed with all of these things, and you realise that this is precisely what the Buddha is talking about, that you have to be very careful and restrain yourself, otherwise your mind gets more distracted outwards. So it's not saying you can't see things, you can't hear things, you can't taste things, and so on. It's just saying be careful and know how these things affect your mind. Okay, moderation in eating. Okay, so not eating too much. Very important part of practice. Wakefulness. Okay, so not sleeping too much. We ought to be devoted to wakefulness. So this is the kind of the usual program of meditation that the Buddha describes, meditating through sitting meditation or walking meditation during the daytime, then during the first watch of the night, then during the second watch of the night, which is about from 10 till 2, then he would sleep down, lie down to sleep, the lion's posture, and then with the mind alert, the mind setting up on the time of getting up. Okay, so that's the trick. You don't not to use, somebody asked yesterday about using alarm clocks, right? So this is the Buddha's alarm clock. It's how to wake up, right? So the Buddha means awakening, right? The awakened one. So this is the perfect alarm clock. When you lie down, set in mind the time you need to get up, and then you just wake up. Easy. Throw away your alarm clock. And then to get up and then to keep on meditating. So these are all the things which for the preparation for meditation. The next one, mindfulness and clear comprehension. So this is that practice of being aware and clearly comprehending throughout all your activities, looking ahead and looking away, bending and stretching the limbs, carrying the robes and the bowl, eating, drinking, chewing, tasting, urinating and defecating. And I do believe that Buddhism is the only religion that contains guidelines on proper practice while doing a poo. I think this is excellent. Walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep. It was something I really missed from growing up in the Catholic tradition. It's like, oh yeah, this is all kind of good and kindness and stuff. But what do I do when I'm doing a poo? Anyway, so... okay, moving along. And then abandoning the hindrances. Okay, so the next section. What more is to be done? There is a case where a monk seeks out a secluded dwelling. Okay? So this is what we were referring to a little bit before when we were talking about Satipatthana. Yeah? A secluded dwelling, a forest, yeah? A shade of a tree, root of a tree, Rukamula, a mountain, a glen, a hillside cave, a charnel ground. I've had this plan, we haven't actually managed to do it yet. We did it only once of doing meditations in the cemeteries around Sydney. There's some great places. And anyway, one day we should get it together. Instead, because they had the meditation group, they're called MedMob. So our friend Sam was organising the MedMob. You go and sit meditation spontaneously in the park or something like that. So we thought we'd co-opt the name, except we'd call it DeadMob. It's like MedMob, only deader. Okay, charnel ground. The tongue will grow. It'd be good because it's really advertised as like meditation for the undead. You know, so vampires and ghosts and zombies can all come to do it. Well, they've got to meditate as well. I mean, come on, they have their suffering. People have no compassion. Okay, jungle grove. The open air, a heap of straw. So these are all the places for meditation, yeah? So notice what one thing that's missing there is an air-conditioned meditation centre with a perfectly designed designer meditation stool, incense burning on the shrine, the gentle strains of New Age music wafting through the air. Right? So we go off to start meditation and we begin by getting attached to all the things, all our surroundings and environment and all. That's good enough. You know, go and sit on a bus stop. That's all right. You can meditate there. You can meditate on the train. Find somewhere simple. If you're putting all that effort, right, into having the perfect meditation cushion and the perfect all these and so on, this particular kind of incense, you know, that really clears the chakras and so on and so forth, and I can meditate better. And you put all this concern into it. All that meaning is that building up this expectation in your mind, so then when you meditate, you're just going to be more annoyed by things, and you hear sounds, and you're going to be more annoyed by it, and so on. Just let go, just meditate wherever. And then you really learn how to let go. Okay. So, after the meal, turning from the arms around, he sits down, crosses his legs, holds his body erect, and it brings mindfulness to the fore, as translated here by Venerable Tanissaro. So, the actual Pali text. Is here. Ujungkai Panidhaya Parivukhang Sating Upatpetwa, having established mindfulness. Okay, brings mindfulness to the fore. The word parimukha. It's one of these things which is an idiom that's a little bit hard to capture in the English translation. I did some research into it at some stage and I basically concluded that parimukha means presence and is more or less a synonym for upatthana. So it's really just a reinforcing of it. So he establishes a presence of mindfulness, something like that. But notice the phrase here. The reason why I'm looking at the Pali is because this is something which often doesn't come across in the translations. And notice he says, brings mindfulness to the fore, right? There's no connection there between the idea of Satipatthana, right? The establishment of mindfulness. I mean, obviously it's got mindfulness in it, but apart from that. But actually the Pali phrase, sating upatthapetva, This is just a verbal resolution of the compound satipatthana. Okay, if you resolve satipatthana, it's sating upattapeti. Yeah, and so that's actually what it's saying is he goes down, he goes to the forest, he sits down, and then does satipatthana. Okay, so right in there is where we put the satipatthana and the whole satipatthana sutta and the practice of mindfulness and breathing and all of those kinds of things. That's actually what he's doing, even though it's not mentioned there. Okay, so this is one of the things that's really important to understand with the suttas, that in each different place, you know, the whole thing is not mentioned, only part of it is mentioned. So you have to understand what these phrases are referring to. So what it means is he goes and sits down, probably does breath meditation, or maybe one of the other meditations and so on. But basically he's doing satipatthana. Okay, then goes on to abandoning the hindrances. And I won't talk about these in detail, simply to mention that this description of abandoning the hindrances is very a useful one, because it not only mentions what the hindrances are, but also gives a strong idea of the positive qualities to develop. So developing, living with an awareness devoid of ill will, sympathetic with the welfare of all living beings, he cleanses his mind of ill will and anger, and so on. And then gives these beautiful similes for the man who takes a loan, and then when his business affairs succeed, then he can repay his debts, and then has extra left over for keeping his wife and his family, and then he think, oh, now he's free of debt, and he would be happy because of that. And the simile of getting better from being sick or being released from prison and so on. And these are wonderful similes, perfect similes for that happiness of meditation. Remember that process of the gradual evolution, the onflowing of joy in the different levels. And notice how hard it is to pin down what is the essence of those things. Those kinds of happiness, they're different all the time. Everyone experiences them differently. You think about that. When somebody comes out of jail, right? Somebody's released from jail. What do they feel like, right? Well, we say they feel happy. Well, pretty much everyone who gets out of jail feels happy, right? But they all feel something different. They don't feel the same happy, right? Someone feels happy because they can see their family again. Someone else feels happy because they can go and get drunk. Someone else feels happy because, well, they're just out of jail, and that's good enough. So the actual feeling they're feeling is different, right? But the overall thing is this happiness is freedom from, and freedom from that prison. And when you meditate and you let go of these five hindrances, that's what it's like. It's like, oh, my whole life I've been in prison. I've been trapped. I didn't even know it. These five hindrances were clouding my mind, darkening my awareness, twisting my thoughts, and making me suffer all the time, every day. And I never even knew it. I thought this was normal. I thought this was the way it's supposed to be. And now for the first time you realize it's not normal at all. Yeah? Or it's normal in the sense statistically it's normal, right? It's common, but it's not how the mind has to be. Yeah? And so this natural process, this unfolding of meditation, has that sense of joy and happiness. Notice how many times in these teachings the Buddha's talking about that joy and happiness. He's not just mentioned it once or twice, constantly going over, repeating this idea that it's the joy and the happiness that comes from this meditation. Okay? So then finally, after giving all of those similes, then when he sees that they've been abandoning him, he becomes glad. When he becomes glad, he becomes full of rapture. When he becomes full of rapture, his body becomes tranquil. When his body is tranquil, he experiences pleasure. When he feels pleasure, his mind goes into samadhi. So again, notice that this is another version of that same process that we talked about before. And I mentioned when we talked about that natural process, the evolution of pleasure, that this recurs constantly through the Buddha's teachings in different forms, slight variation. And this is one more variation. Hindrances go, the mind feels pleasure, pleasure deepens and deepens until finally one goes into samadhi. And then we have the description of the four jhanas. So I obviously can't go into this in too much detail, but just very briefly, we'll have a look at the jhana formula, because this is such an important part of Buddhist meditation. I will look at it in the Pali, and I will hope that we've got the dictionary back. No, we do not have the dictionary back. No, it's obviously still just being maintained, unfortunately. So, first jhana, viviche vakamehi, viviche akusalehi dhamehi. So quite secluded from the senses. So the word karma here means the objects of the five senses, sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. They're all gone. Viviche akusalehi dhamehi, so freed from all kind of wholesome dhammas, greed, hatred, delusion, all of these things, all gone. So with vitaka and with vichara, these are some of the most poorly translated terms in all of Buddhism. Savitaka, savichara. I won't go into it in too much detail, but what they don't mean is thinking. Okay? I mean, even if you're in just ordinary meditation and you sit there, you can have a peaceful state of mind without thinking. When the Buddha was talking about these uttari manusa dhammas, these qualities which are beyond that of the human, and very profound qualities which he called akin to nirvana itself. He wasn't sitting there thinking about this and that during the meditation, I can guarantee you that. What vitaka and vichara here mean is applying the mind onto the meditation and then keeping the mind with the meditation. Okay? So if you think about that in that process of meditation, as you're sitting there, as you're watching the breath, you're bringing the mind onto the breath and then you're keeping it there. But the mind drifts, it moves away a little bit, so you bring it back and keep it there. Moves a little bit and drifts away and bring it back. So it's just that rhythm, almost like a massaging. And in the simile that we're coming in a minute, we actually have that idea of massaging is brought forth. So, savitakam, savicharam, vivekajam, diti sukham. So the rapture and bliss which is born of seclusion. Of course, the seclusion that's meant here is the seclusion talked about in the first part of the phrase, seclusion from the senses and seclusion from unwholesome qualities of mind. And that's what gives rise to that joy and rapture. And so on enters the first jhana. So notice that in the simile here, it talks about the like a skilled bathman or bathman's apprentice would pour bath powder onto a brass basin and knead it together, sprinkling it again and again with water so that his ball of bath powder, saturated, moisture-laden, permeated within and without, would nevertheless not drip. Okay? So I'm not quite familiar with this bath powder that it's talking about, but it seems to be something like a ball of dough or something like that. Do anyone know what this bath powder is? Anyone actually used it? Or, no? But it seems it's like a kind of ball of dough or something like that, that you sort of make sure it has the right amount of moisture all the way through it, and then it's kind of kneaded until it's the right consistency. Yeah? And so that's that kind of idea, that's what that vitaka and vichara is that kind of kneading motion. That's kind of massaging it until it's consistent and even throughout. And then notice that image of water. We started the very first image that I showed you. There's an image of water in meditation, and these coming through again and again through these meditation the four jhanas. And the water is a symbol for the rapture and the pleasure of the meditation. Okay, so the water is a simile for the pleasure, the sukha. Then the second jhana, the vitaka vichara ends. Vitaka vichara nang vupasama. Then one has internal confidence, unification of mind without vitaka vichara and with the rapture and bliss born of samadhi. So this is that second jhana and is illustrated with the idea of a pool of water which is like, there's no water coming in or flowing out from it, but a clear mountain pool and the water well up from underneath it. And that welling up from underneath is a feeling of rapture. Yeah, it has that uplifting feeling. Yeah, like a spring at the bottom of a clear mountain pool. Yeah, you feel that uplifting feeling of rapture. But then even that becomes abandoned. The third jhana, the rapture abandons. One abides equanimous. Okay, so notice that here rapture is replaced by equanimity. Both of these are emotions, they're emotional responses. So what, in both cases you have a feeling of pleasure, so you're experiencing pleasure in the meditation, but with the rapture you're responding to that pleasure by a very subtle sense of excitement. Okay, so it's a slightly positive response to that pleasure, the uplift, that surge, that thrill. Very subtle, but still there. But now, it's just equanimity. And you still feel pleasure, but you have complete equanimity towards that pleasure. And this is the distinguishing feature of the third jhana. Mindful and clearly comprehending, experiencing bliss with his body, he says, one dwells in pleasure who has equanimity and mindfulness. Fortunately, I don't have time to go into all of these things in too much detail, but one thing to notice is that when it uses the word kaya in this whole context, it doesn't mean the physical body. The word kaya has a range of meanings where it starts out meaning the physical body, but by here we're talking about something much more subtle. It means something a bit more like the astral body or the subtle body that you have, that they talk about sometimes in kind of modern spiritual circles. But really what it is it's a word that's emphasizing the imminence and the directness of the personal experience that you're having at that time. This is how the word kaya means. There's an idiom in the Pali when it's talking about meditation, it calls an experienced meditator is called a kaya sakhi. Okay, kaya sakhi literally is a body witness. Okay, sakhi means with one's own eyes. So kaya sakhi is a body witness, right? So it's talking about somebody who has actually directly personally experienced it. And this is the sense of this idiomatic use of the word kaya, which is coming here. So don't misunderstand this as referring to sitting there and sort of physically feeling these feelings through your body. By this stage, the feeling of your body has disappeared. You're absorbed into an experience in the mind. So in the third jhana, then according to the simile, you no longer have that upsurging of water underneath, because that's the rapture and that's now stilled, and so it's like the lotus which is growing underneath the water, permeated with the cool, clear water. And this is that simile in the third jhana, again the water being the sukha. And then finally, the fourth jhana, sukhasa cha pahana, dukhasa cha pahana, pubeva somana sudomana sanangatangama. So with the abandoning of pleasure and pain and the previous disappearance of joy and grief, one enters the fourth jhana, which has a purity of equanimity and mindfulness, upekha satiparisuddhiṃ. Okay? So now there's no pleasure left at all, purely equanimity. This one is described because there's no pleasure, then the water has disappeared from the simile, and it's described like a man who's emerged from the water and is sitting beside the pond after having a bath and sitting there wrapped in a pure, clean, white cloth. Again, so these are very beautiful similes, and so really capture something about the feel of these experiences. So we have both, you know, in understanding what these things are, we have the literal description in terms of the mental factors, the jhana factors which are present or absent at each stage, so that kind of literal psychological description at each stage. We also have like the aesthetic or the emotional side of it with the similes, which is giving you an impression of how they feel. And we also have the practices which lead to it, we have the outcomes of it, we have what the process is like. So we have all these different details and different ways of looking at what this experience is. And all of that enriches our understanding of what these jhana experiences are, how to practice them, and what their role is within the path of Buddhism as a whole. Obviously we could spend the whole of this course, in fact, just talking about the jhanas and their implication in Buddhism. But anyway, we haven't. We only had 15 minutes to talk about it. So are there any questions before we break for the our cup of tea, afternoon tea, and we'll have a discussion session following this. Okay, so let's break, have a cup of tea, and we'll see you back here at 20 past for the discussion session. So this is a list of five dhammas, and I think I've mentioned this before in this series of talk, but I just wanted to bring it out again and remind you. Once again, we see this process, the unfolding of things, yeah? Starting with the basics, the sila, keeping the precepts, and then the sutta here is learning, right? So sutta is not the same word as sutta, not, this is not, sutta, which means the discourses, right? Actually a different word that happens to sound the same, and confusingly enough, mean pretty much the same. Okay, so this is sutta, literally means what is heard, and what you hear. And so this means, of course, in the oral tradition, then what you learn is what you hear. So this is simply means learning, although in fact it actually means learning the suttas, so it's all a bit confusing and stuff. But anyway, sila sutta. Sakata is discussion, yeah? And so important to understand that we don't learn passively. Yeah? We learn through the discussion and engagement and involvement. And all of the things that we've been listening to today, the discussion and talking about it with each other is an intrinsic part of how we integrate that and how we make it part of who we are. Samatha, calm, and vipassana, insight or discernment. So our practice involves all of these things. Yeah? So we don't think of practice as being either one thing or the other. And we also shouldn't think of one thing as being better than the other. Right? It's not like that. This is, often we have this thing that they call, in the psychologists call, spiritual bypassing. Right? And so, you know, this is what you see. Everyone wants to go straight to vipassana. Vipassana is better than all these other ones. Right? Oh, you don't have to read the suttas, just do vipassana. You don't have to do samatha, just do vipassana. You don't have to talk about the Dhamma, just do. So all of these things are being bypassed. It doesn't mean there's nothing wrong with doing the vipassana, but it's got to be in the context of the path as a whole in order to be balanced and to be integrated. So this is something that I'm trying to emphasize right throughout this course, is how when the Buddha presents things, he presents it in that time, in that place, in a way that's meaningful for those people or that person, in a way that's going to be very helpful for him or her. But in each case, we have to understand that within the overall context of the path as a whole. So this is why it's important to pay attention to both these things, both to the overall context, the patterns of the Dhamma, which we see repeated again and again and again. We know that. Then when we recognize a particular teaching, we'll be able to know, oh, okay, this applies in that context. It's for this person at that time for that reason. And it fits in this way. So remember all of those supporting conditions which the Buddha laid down for meditation. You know, and I think that it is very striking how the kinds of supporting conditions which the Buddha said for meditation are very often not the kinds of things that people actually say are good for their meditation. Right? So people say, oh, I'm trying to meditate, but it was too noisy. Right? And that's actually not something that the Buddha's really emphasizing there. Oh, yeah, of course, having a quiet place is good for meditation. We all know that, right? But that's not the main thing that he's emphasizing, is it? Yeah? The main thing he's emphasizing is the sila, keeping your precepts, being generous, learning, understanding the Dhamma, developing that right intention, the wholesome states of mind, having that opportunity to have good friends and so on to discuss and all of these things. So it doesn't take like a hugely specialized environment, you know, like we often go on retreats and we try to control everything on the retreat. You know, we don't talk, we don't hear anything. There's no TV, there's no books, right? And some retreats, Jeff Dawson was saying that on the Zen retreats they're not even allowed to look at each other, right? Because that's like eye contact. That's too much, right? To look in another person's eyes, you've got to keep your eyes downcast, and so you set up these very specialized conditions. Now, that has a purpose, right? And when you do that, you can actually experience those states of peace of mind and deep insight and clarity pretty quickly, right? Even just a few days on a retreat, you can feel it. It really makes a difference, yeah? But of course the problem is that it also goes away just as quickly when you come off the retreat, yeah? So this is why these aren't the kinds of things which the Buddha was so much emphasizing, yeah? And he's emphasizing these things because it's the long term he's interested in, right? He doesn't particularly care whether this weekend you have a nice meditation experience or not, right? It's this kind of instant thing, instant gratification, right? I want to get on a retreat and I want to get my good samadhi right now. So the Buddha's interested in the long term. Yeah, how do you develop and grow as a person in the long term? And that's why all of these things have their part to play. So we shouldn't think that these little things aren't part of the path, right? When I first went to the Santi Monastery all those years ago, and I remember the first, second layman who stayed in the monastery, he came out of one day with the immortal phrase, I'll never forget his phrase, the Buddha was talking about liberation, not about washing up. Right? So for him, this was more than enough reason to say, I'm not going to bother doing the washing up. I don't know what the Buddha was talking about. Of course, if you know the vinaya, you know the Buddha actually did talk about washing up. Yeah, and so there's plenty of guidance on how to wash your bowl and how to you put it out in the sun to dry it and you put it away and what places you've got to put it. And actually the Buddha was very careful with all these things, right? And he would never despise any of these little dhammas. Yeah, each act that we do, we bring a sense of care, mindfulness and attention to it. Yeah, and these are all, to come back to that simile I mentioned at the beginning of the day, these are all those little raindrops falling on the mountains. Yeah, all of which are building the puddles, building the creeks, flowing over into the streams, and all of them flowing down to the great ocean. So what I would hope is that from today's session, what you take away is this idea or a bit of hope. You think, well, look, you've been doing meditation, and I know most people here will have been doing a regular or semi-regular meditation practice, and I know that I've spoken to so many people over the years, and people often thinking, oh, it's difficult, and it's a struggle, and how do I do more, and how do I keep the practice going? And so what I'm trying to suggest is that, well, rather than worrying too much about that, put a little bit more attention into these simple things, the basic things, yeah? Rather than going to work and thinking, oh, these people are gossiping and it's really unwholesome and it's really annoying me, my meditation. Why don't you think about, well, perhaps I could buy a bunch of flowers and then put that in the staff room at work and people would be a little bit happier and maybe they wouldn't bitch so much, right? I don't know, maybe it'll work, maybe it won't, but you've got a good intention, yeah? Maybe you can do something, do some small things that can help people and encourage them. And maybe you can put a bit more attention. There's things like the sakacha, the discussion. I think it's something which we often don't really appreciate, yeah? And think, okay, well, that's something that I can do, right? You know, you've got some Dhamma friends and things like that. Maybe we could have just a Dhamma tea time sometime. It doesn't have to be a big deal. Have a Dhamma tea time and maybe ask one of the members of the group to bring a short sutta passage or a saying of the Dhamma, just one line or a verse or something like that. A verse from the Dhammapada could be. And then they can just read that, you can drink tea together and then talk about whatever that brings up. Yeah? These are simple things that everyone can do that can help to create these supporting conditions. That's trying to make your job easier, right? Rather than doing all the hard stuff, do the easy stuff. Anybody can have a cup of tea with a friend and talk about the Dhamma. It's easy, yeah? So let's do those easy things and let those easy things work together and build those supporting conditions which is going to make the hard stuff come naturally. Yeah? Okay, so that was all I wanted to say for this afternoon. I don't know if there's any questions or anything anyone wants to bring up before we finish up for this afternoon. So maybe we might, let's sit meditation together for just 2 or 5 minutes before we finish. So thank you very much everybody for your presence and your attention for the today, and I look forward to seeing you all once more next month. Let's finish by paying respects. Supatipanno bhagavato sarvaka sangho sangham.